y'all. Thanks for listening to Killer Queens.
Or KQ if you're nasty.
Welcome to the show where two 90s loving country chicks gab about true crime and tell each other to talk to the hand because the face ain't listening. I'm Torella.
And I'm Tori.
And we're sisters who have always loved true crime and decided to turn that obsession into a show with a light take on the topic.
Kind of like diet true crime, it's all the flavor and fewer calories.
Now with our show, you'll get true crime, 90s nostalgia, and a few four-letter words sprinkled in.
Because I always say that Polly Pockets and true crime go together like peas and carrots.
Be sure to check out our case submission form on our website at killerqueenspodcast.com and follow us on social media and YouTube.
Now grab your Surge, your 3D Cool Ranch Doritos, and your kitten surprise, and let's get into the episode.
This episode contains discussion of child abuse, child sexual abuse, grooming, cults, radical religious practices, and child death. Listener discretion is advised.
On April 19, 1993, FBI agents began pouring tear gas into a compound known as Mount Carmel in Waco, Texas. It was the final act of a 51-day standoff that had taken place between law enforcement and a religious group known as the Branch Davidians. After a failed attempt by the ATF to serve a warrant to arrest the group's leader, David Koresh, for stockpiling illegal weapons, the standoff began. By the end, 82 Branch Davidians were dead, including 28 children, and four ATF agents had been killed. The country was left with questions that remain unanswered to this day, the most important one being, who was responsible for the 86 deaths that happened at Mount Carmel?
Hey, you guys, welcome to Killer Queens. If you've never been here before, we want to give you just a little information about how the show is set up and what it's meant to accomplish. If you have been here before, welcome back. You can just use that handy skip ahead feature here if you want to.
We want to give a message to friends and family of the victims. We know that there may be someone involved in the case who might listen one day, and we want you to know that our intention is to only bring awareness to this case. And while we do use personal stories in some instances and our own humor in order to tell the story in a way that listeners can relate, we have the utmost respect for victims and their families.
We created Killer Queens to be a place where we can have open discussions about cases just like you would with friends. We are not investigators. We use information that is available to the public, such as documentaries, case files, and media coverage. Using this information, we intend to tell the story of what happened in each case that we cover. Now, will you agree with our interpretations or conclusions of each case? Well, heck no.
Mm-mm. We each approach cases from different perspectives, life experiences, and beliefs that we already have in place. And sometimes these differences are slight, yet they can be wide enough to cause divide and upset some of those listening. We do our best to present the facts as we find them in our research, but we do bring our own perspectives to the case. We understand that you will too. We want you to know that this is a safe space to discuss differences and opinions in a civilized manner. Our style may not be your personal preference, and if that's the case, we know you'll be able to find one of the many other shows out there to tell the story the way you want to hear it. We can be grown-ups about it if you can.
Now, if we are your cup of tea and you want even more KQ, you can join our Patreon and get access to our entire catalog of episodes ad-free and access to bonus episodes too. And I'll give you just a little hint if you're an ad skipper, but you still want the deals that we have from our sponsors each week, you can scroll down to the show notes and see what coupons we have available for you right down there.
But you didn't hear it from us.
That's a pro tip, but I'll deny ever sharing it.
Right. So all that being said, let's get into the story.
Okay, so we are going to briefly recap part one. We learned about David Koresh and his upbringing. Throughout his life, he was drawn to religion and the teachings of the Bible, kind of. He took control of the Branch Davidians and assumed power over the followers. Remember, he took all the women as his brides and forbade any of the men any sexual acts, going as far as to dissolve their marriages. And he called this the New Light, right? That's what he... Okay. You know, he gets all these revelations. He's like, actually, God told me you can't have sex with your wife anymore. I'm supposed to. Again, take it up with him.
Yeah. And this is for your own good. So yeah.
I don't make the rules. I just follow them. Right. Koresh was said to have molested and impregnated girls as young as 12. So part one left off right as the ATF stormed Mount Carmel in Waco, Texas, because the group had been stockpiling illegal weapons. So. after speaking with both. Oh, and thank you to Madison for writing this up.
Yes.
And we had two people request this case, and those people are one that we are going to mess the name up again. I'm so sorry. Lonron Pirate and Kate Lindsay. I am so sorry for what I just did there. Please forgive me. I know not what I do.
Yeah.
So after speaking with both the ATF and Wayne on the phone, Sheriff Lynch was finally able to negotiate a ceasefire. So the shooting had stopped. No one was to do anything except to gather their wounded. The ATF agents gathered all of their team members who had been shot, and unfortunately, four of those agents were dead. 16 of their agents were wounded. Ambulances were brought out to transport the injured, but there were not enough to carry them all. And people were calling for more ambulances, and they're like, they're all there, dude. Like, they're all there.
Mm.
Agents were moved out in truck beds, in cars. One was even wrapped in a blanket and placed on the hood of a truck. And like literally other agents kind of like held him in place and ran with the truck as it drove. I mean,
it's crazy.
Did we mention though that during the shootout, the original news crew was parked behind the ATF trucks through the whole thing?
Whew.
I mean, this story is not gonna get itself. You know what I mean?
Stressful day on the job, man.
Yeah, it's necessary.
Apparently, yeah.
To do this. So they recorded the entire time. The reporter told his cameraman, you've got to hide your tape, right? Because nobody's gonna want this tape to get out. So they hid it in his shirt. And the ATF seemed pretty irritated that the news had been there. The news people think it's because the raid didn't end the way they had wanted it to. So they kind of like had, you know, egg on their face, and they were embarrassed that people were there to witness that. Yeah.
Yeah.
And they were kind of like the ATF agents, as he's walking through to leave, they're like, have some respect. Get out of here. Get out of here. Shoo. Like they're shooing him like he's a stray dog. Shoo. Get out of here. No. And he's like, I am trying to get out of here. Yeah, like I'm trying to leave. It's what I'm doing and whatever. Their news unit was waiting away from the ATF, and the journalist and photographer quickly got the tape to their newsroom to be televised. Here's my question, though. Wouldn't you be able to see who the first shots were because they were there the whole time? Like, wouldn't they have presumably started recording before the shooting started?
I would think so, but I really don't know.
It seems like,
I mean, even with that footage, there's people still don't know. So
yeah, maybe like maybe it just was too confusing. But I was just like, couldn't that be the?
Well, and they're behind the ATF trucks, so maybe there wasn't a really good shot of it or something. I don't know.
Yeah, that's true. The ATF was obviously mourning the agents that had been killed, but the Davidians had not gotten away unscathed. It's unknown how many Davidians were killed or ended up dead as a result of the initial gunfight, but we do know that many were injured. Little Heather Jones, who'd watched as one of the women in the compound was shot through the window, looked out in the hallway to see her grandfather, Perry Jones, crawling and screaming in pain. He'd been shot in the stomach and was begging for somebody to end his life. One of the Davidians eventually did kill him, knowing that they weren't going to be able to send him out for medical care. David Koresh was actually also critically wounded with at least one gunshot wound in his lower abdomen and like kind of hip area.
And it went like through him.
It was a gunshot. It was a
mm-hmm.
dead ass gunshot.
Yeah.
No cap. I mean, no cap.
Stop it. Okay, so clearly things had not gone according to plan for the ATF, and they weren't really sure of their next step, so they contacted the FBI, who sent resources to Waco along with their hostage rescue team, the HRT. A command post was set up 8 miles away from 8 miles away at the local airport. The FBI was now the lead agency and hell-bent on resolving what the ATF had started. Communications were quickly initiated between law enforcement and the Davidians. ATF's Jim Cavanaugh and the local sheriff, Larry Lynch, were speaking directly with Koresh, Steve Snyder, and Wayne Martin. And we are going to play the first communication between negotiators and David Koresh.
Hello.
Hello.
Yeah, this is Lieutenant Lynch. May I help you?
Yeah, there are 75 men around our building and they're shooting at us in Mount Carmel.
Mount Carmel?
Yeah, tell them there are children and women in here and to call it off.
All right. Hello? I hear gunfire. Oh, shit. Hello? Who is it? Hello?
Call it off!
Who is it? Hello?
Yeah, this is Lynch.
Hey, Lynch?
Yeah.
That's a kind of a funny name there.
Huh?
Oh, listen, no, look.
Now, who am I speaking with?
This is David Koresh.
Okay, David.
The Notorious. What'd you guys do that for?
Well, Dave, what I'm doing is I'm trying to establish some communication links with you.
No. Let me tell you something.
Yes, sir.
You see, you brought a bunch of guys out here and you killed some of my children. We told you we wanted to talk. No, how come you guys try to be ATF agents? How come you try to be so big all the time?
Okay, David.
Now, there's a bunch of us dead. There's a bunch of you guys dead. Now that's your fault.
So the first and immediate demand from Koresh was he wanted media attention. He told negotiators that the local media had to play a message from him, and everybody was like, okay, so we don't really know what he's going to say, obviously. And I understand that they were like, I don't want his message to get out there necessarily.
Yeah, we don't want people to think we're like in agreement or aligned with this message.
Right. But the thing is, Koresh, finally, after this request or demand, he finally was like, okay, I'll release two children from inside the compound each time the message is played.
Two by two, Noah's Ark.
That's what I was going to say. There is a connection to the Bible there, of course. So though law enforcement was happy to have the children be released, their parents were very upset. Koresh told his followers as well as the negotiators that his priority was spreading his message to the world. To appease the parents, when the children were released, they would come out of the compound. They were brought straight to the negotiators. They'd allow the children to talk to Koresh or to their parents on the phone and tell them, we're okay, everything is fine. It wasn't long before Gary Noesner from the FBI was appointed as the lead negotiator. Phone lines within the compound were cut, only allowing outgoing calls to the negotiators. Armored vehicles moved closer to the building, and even over the phone, it was easy to tell that Koresh was getting frustrated. He assured Gary Noesner that they were not considering suicide. Within the first 5 days of the standoff, a total of 21 children and two adults were released from the compound. They were taken to the nearby Methodist Children's Home. In exchange, negotiators were forced to publicize more of Koresh's messages. Early in the morning on Tuesday, March 2nd, day 3 of the standoff, Koresh recorded an audio tape of his religious teaching over an hour long. He demanded that his message be broadcasted nationally by the Christian Broadcasting Network, and he promised that the negotiators that if his message was broadcasted nationally, he and the rest of the Davidians would exit the compound calmly. Koresh said, I'm going to come out first. The kids are going to come out after me, the women, then the men, and then Steve Schneider is going to be the caboose. The message was broadcasted early that afternoon, and law enforcement was excited. They were like, okay, yes, this is the end of it. We did it. Day mm-hmm. three.
They're going to come out. We did our part. Now they're just going to come out.
Yep. Koresh told negotiators that he was ready to come out and that everyone was lining up to say goodbye to him. Negotiators just asked that Koresh and his followers come out while it's still light outside. Ambulances were brought in preparation of treating the injured Davidians. The sun was starting to set when negotiators got on the phone with Schneider, and he told them that while the followers were saying goodbye to Koresh, Koresh started praying. He then told Schneider that he had received a sign from God that he needed to wait.
Okay, that's not what we talked about.
No, we held up our end of the bargain. We mm-hmm. played all of your over an hour long messages that mm-hmm. you wanted to have put out there. Mm-hmm. And now you're going back on your word?
Yeah. Like,
I'm sure Koresh was like,
yeah,
they believed everything I said.
Exactly. Still laughing about it. I mean, you know what I mean? The FBI, who was obviously scooper duper pissed that Koresh went back on his agreement, continued to compromise with Koresh. They dropped murder charges against the two elderly women who had left the compound the prior day, I guess from the dead ATF agents. Is there any way that they would know that it was these elderly women that did it? I don't know, but...
Well, but I think that they were... The ATF or whoever was trying to get them on... Anybody that was an adult that was in this...
Yeah, they were going to charge.
Shootout. Yeah.
So... Everyone is getting pretty impatient, and David Koresh's explanations are just not helping. So when explaining why he didn't leave the compound as he had agreed to, he said that he was no longer dealing with law enforcement's, quote, bureaucratic system of government, and, quote, he was now dealing with his father. Obviously, his heavenly
himself.
Father. Yeah, right. No perimeter had been established around Mount Carmel, so it was difficult to tell where law enforcement should be. The FBI's
HRT.
Yeah, rescue team, the HRT, had several members that climbed onto the roof of the small house. Remember that the ATF had been occupying. They set up their scopes, and they were able to kind of see the whole front of the compound. They were very concerned that they didn't really have anywhere where they could see the back of the compound. So they made a plan, the HRT did, to take control of a detached garage area behind the compound, and this was successful. So now law enforcement has visuals of pretty much the entire compound. Over the next few days, negotiators continued to talk with Koresh and other Davidians over the phone with no significant progress in ending the standoff. The HRT and other law enforcement agents were starting to get really impatient. Nothing is happening. There's no movement. But negotiators were saying, look, we're building rapport with him. We're building trust with him. We have to build a relationship with him to get movement. Like, it's going to take some time.
Yeah.
They were playing the long game, which I don't know. Again, I'm not a hostage negotiator. So if you've been doing that for years and you tell me this is the way it needs to go, then I'm going to follow that. Like,
well, I was going to say, I mean, I understand the urgency to try to get all of these people out. I get it. And the children, I totally understand it. 3 days, it's not, I mean, now we might be at what, 6, 7 days? I don't know. But it's... I can see both sides of it. It's like, okay, come on. We got to get him out. We have to get him out. We have to do this. But I can also see the negotiators being like, you guys have to be patient. Like, it's going to take some time because Koresh is not going to play by the rules. He's not going to be like, oh, they're like, if a cop told me to do something and if I was in this situation, I'd be like, here I am. Like, no, I'm not. But David Koresh doesn't give a shit. So.
Right. And we've already gone this far and you've already seen what has happened. So it's incredibly probable, not even just possible, but probable that more people are going to get hurt if we barrel in there. Right.
Yeah.
Like, and it's also interesting to me that the FBI's team is called the Hostage Rescue Team. But they literally do everything in their power to make things just significantly worse, it seems like. Who suffers? Yeah. The hostages.
Mm-hmm.
Which I know that the Davidians don't consider themselves hostages, but this is who the government
Children
is
are.
Considering. Yeah, for sure. 100%. Yeah, they were hostages before the government came along. On March 3rd, Koresh sent one of several videos of himself to negotiators. In this particular one, the FBI could see that he was critically wounded. So negotiators used that to try to get him to come out and get medical attention. They were telling him, look, doctors are concerned about this. If you let it go untreated, you could get a blood infection. You could die. That could travel to your brain. Like, it's not worth it, man. Come out, get treated, you know? And he was like, you're not getting me with that one. Absolutely not. It didn't bother him at all. More videos were sent of Koresh surrounded by some of the children or other Davidians, with Koresh instructed the children to say that they felt safe and happy. I mean, he's totally leading them.
Well, he's like, do you feel safe? Are you loved? Are you happy?
Who loves you? Who treats you good?
Yes. And he's like, tell them. Tell the camera. Tell them.
Yeah. That doesn't help, dude. Like, you're obviously making it so that they have to say you're good to them. Like,
yeah, exactly.
On Friday, March 5th, 9-year-old Heather Jones was released from the compound. And if you want to hear all of this from her perspective, you can watch the Netflix thing. She's also in the Hulu thing. She talks a lot about it. And this was very difficult for her because at the time, like, she grew up in this. This was all she knew. She didn't want to be away from the people that
she knew. Her family that she, yeah.
Yeah. And she was scared of the agents, of course, because it seemed like they wanted to kill them. I mean, that's as a child, that's all you know. Koresh had demanded that the FBI send in milk for the children, but they refused to do so unless more children were sent out. Koresh said he's not going to release any more of the children because they were all his biological descendants. Through more conversation, the FBI agreed to send in 6 gallons of milk for the children. On Friday, March 12th, day 13 of the standoff, adult Davidian Kathy Schroeder left the compound. So her 3-year-old son, Brian, had been released earlier during the standoff, and she wanted to be with him. And she had other children, too, like older children. And I don't know this, but was Brian her son with David?
I'm not sure about that.
Because the older children were her children with her first husband, I think, who's no longer there. Or maybe from a previous marriage before she went to Waco. I'm not totally sure. But investigators said all the children had been released together. And then Brian is left there at the children's area, not alone in the sense that there are other children there, but alone in the sense that his siblings are no longer there because the older kid's father came and picked them up and said, these are my kids, I'm getting them out of here. So Brian, in Kathy's eyes, was left alone and he was upset. And so they were able to use that and talk her into coming out. And they're like, you know, what Brian needs right now is a hug from his mommy and he needs you and like all this stuff. So she comes out. And she said, too, the people that were coming out, she's like, the media kind of made it seem like any adult that came out of the compound was coming out to be saved, that we were scared and we were trying to be saved. She's like, that's not what was happening. They're not afraid of dying. She said, quote, I don't care about living. I care about living for God. So she was fine to stay there and die. But she felt bad that her son was without her and upset. So she was taken directly to see her son, which is captured on film. And eventually, so they let them have, seemed like a good amount of time, not a good amount of time, like that's enough, but a couple hours maybe together, something, I don't know, where they're just together. And then eventually they come in and say, okay, well, we need to go take Brian to eat. It's time for him to eat. And she's like, okay. So Kathy was taken out of the room and then she was immediately arrested and she was sent to jail. And so she said she didn't get to see him again after that. Now, unfortunately for the negotiators, this was televised. And guess who can see everything that's on the TV, guys? The Davidians. And they can hear on the radio. So now they know, because the FBI says, absolutely, any adult that comes out of there, you will be charged.
Yeah. And negotiators are probably, I feel bad, really bad for the negotiators, because they're just doing their job. Or trying to, but at every turn, somebody is messing it up for them. You know?
Like, and because the negotiators are like, why the fuck would anybody come out if they know they're just going to get arrested? Of course they're not going to come out. Like, you can't do that. You can charge them later when this is over. But if you charge them right now and the Davidians know this is happening, so now we have... It was obvious that there was breakdowns in communication and like one hand doesn't know what the other hand is doing or one hand is just disagreeing with what the other hand is doing. And like, I'm doing this, you do that. And it doesn't work together. And like HRT is just like, I'm going to do what I want to do.
Right.
Even though you're telling me this isn't how this works, like, you know, whatever. Well, now David Koresh knows that. And so why would he even trust the negotiators anymore? Because everything they try to do, the FBI or the ATF or whoever turns around and, you know, yanks the
rug out from under him, right?
Right.
And also now we've got all of the trust that they have attempted to build with David Koresh out the window.
Yep. Why should I believe you?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. And not only can the Davidians see what's happening on TV, so can the rest of the world. I mean, this was completely, it was televised. It was all over. It was national news. It was international news. I mean, it was crazy. And of course, like all kinds of news stations are flooding in now. You know, initially it was just those local stations and now it's everybody. Family members of Davidians also came to the area. They were hoping that their loved ones were safe. They were trying to get messages into their family members. As the days went by, again, no real progress of any movement being made or any resolutions. People started parking their cars near the news vans and selling merchandise, like bumper stickers and hats, either supporting the Davidians or criticizing the government. One of the men selling anti-government bumper stickers was none other than old Timothy Noodle McVeigh. Noodle himself.
Limp dick Noodle McVeigh.
Exactly. Who would later go on to commit the Oklahoma City bombing on the anniversary of Waco, by the way. The power inside the compound was shut off, leaving the Davidians without heat. The negotiators were forced to tell Koresh that his mother had hired an attorney to represent him. On March 19th, the FBI delivered documents from Koresh's lawyers. This was done in an attempt to address concerns from the Davidians. And in the meantime, several other adults exited the compound. The FBI had started using more extreme tactics to try to push the Davidians out. They used bright lights that were focused directly into the compound. At night, they played extremely loud Christmas music over the speakers, as well as Tibetan chants. They played the Nancy Sinatra song, "These Boots Were Made for Walking," for 24 hours on repeat. They played the sounds of a jet engine taking off, door slamming, a rabbit being slaughtered, phone off the hook. Loud.
Oh, very, very, very loud.
I mean, this is torture.
Mm-hmm.
This is psychological torture. And they know that that's what they're doing.
And it didn't work.
Of course it didn't work. And the negotiators were like, hang on. You are deeming these people as extremely unstable. Or maybe it was David Thibodeau that said this, actually. You're taking people who you are telling the world are extremely unstable and are not right in the head. And then you're going to psychologically torture them and make things that much more unstable. What did you think would happen?
Exactly.
It's just, and negotiators are pissed. They're like, we have never been taught. In fact, we've always been taught not to use these types of techniques. They can only make things worse.
Mm-hmm.
They have never made things better. If you put somebody into a very agitated, sleep-deprived state, do they think
it's
more rationally
more
or less?
Yeah. Yes.
Exactly. It just, come on. Angry about the tactics being used and nearing their breaking point with having no power in the compound, Koresh and his men refused to speak with negotiators. And during a press conference on March 24th, the FBI called Koresh a liar and a coward. So now they're just pissing him off all over the place.
Yeah.
Despite the Texas Rangers and the U.S. Assistant U.S. attorneys advising against it, Koresh's lawyer was allowed to meet with him at the compound.
His lawyer was none other than Dick DeGuerin,
who represented
Little Bobby Durst.
And got him off on the murder of. He got him off on that one, didn't he? Yeah, he did.
I think so.
Yeah, he sure did. Yeah. So I saw him and I was like, oh my God, Dick DeGuerin.
Well, I know that name anywhere because I remember he just sounds like, you know, hello, I'm Dick DeGuerin.
Like, yeah. It's like, it's one of those names you remember. I mean, Gosh, and if Koresh had followed what he advised, he may very well have gotten a not guilty verdict for him. I mean, I don't know. He's just
Aaron, he's a great lawyer.
Yeah, incredible lawyer. So the lawyer told, like, law enforcement was like, you know, do you want a bulletproof vest? Are you real scared to go in there, you know, with these crazy people or whatever? And he was like, I'm not afraid of them, but I'm afraid y'all are going to shoot me by accident. I'm afraid, like, he was like, I want you to show all of your snipers what I look like so that when I go in and I come back out, they don't accidentally shoot me.
Mm-hmm.
Like, I mean, that says something. After his visit, DeGaren relayed to the FBI that the Davidians were going to leave the compound after they observed Passover. So now we've got just one more thing.
There's another, yeah.
As soon as that's over, we'll come out. That was on Monday, April 5th. And then after that happened, nobody left. Surprise.
The hostage rescue team's patience had run out quite some time ago, obviously. Most of them had been fully convinced since the standoff began that Koresh wouldn't be exiting the compound willingly. They were more than ready to breach the compound and force everyone out. Solid plan. On Friday, April 9th, day 41 of the standoff, Koresh sent two letters to the FBI writing that they were being called to judgment. Several experts analyzed the letters and strongly believed that Koresh was psychotic. Could have told you that one. Mm-hmm. And wouldn't be leaving the compound willingly. After discussions with high-ranking FBI officials and the HRT commander, a plan to deploy tear gas was proposed. On Monday, April 12th, the plan was presented to U.S. Attorney General Janet Reno. I can only think about Will Smith as Janet Reno. Will Ferrell,
excuse me.
We were just talking about Independence Day, so I got Will Smith on the brain. Will Ferrell as Janet Reno.
Hi, I'm Janet Reno. Welcome to my dance party, coming to you live from the deck of a battleship. Psst, it's really just my basement.
But it's reported that she asked several times, quote, why now, why not wait? And it was explained to her as, quote, not an all-out assault, but as a tactile whereby gas will be inserted in stages, initially into only one small area of the compound. The goal was to allow the exit through uncontaminated portions of the compound.
Put a pin in that. Yeah.
The FBI also showed Reno affidavits from the Branch Davidians that alleged child abuse going on in the compound. They did not show her any of the videos that Koresh had sent out with him sitting with the kids. Allegedly, these videos were left out because it was thought that the videos might make some people sympathize with Koresh and the Davidians.
I mean, I don't think so. I think that the videos, like, you know, we talked about, show that he's obviously controlling what they say. But for whatever reason, they decided not to show those.
And Reno asked for more information regarding whether the compound's water supply could be cut off and how long do they believe the Davidians could survive in the compound without further assistance. On April 14th, Koresh informed negotiators that he would not exit until he had written his manuscript explaining the seven seals. The seven seals are the first series of God's end time judgments. And by this time, it seemed that no one believed that Koresh would follow through on exiting. I mean, how many excuses has he given? Well, after this happens, and we'll leave. After this happens, I'm going to get out of here. And it never comes. So,
yeah. And his manuscript, I mean, he wasn't like, let me jot down a couple paragraphs on this. It was going to be like this lengthy, even more than 18 pages front and back.
Exactly. Yes. And it was estimated that the Davidians were stocked with enough food and supplies to last an entire year.
Wow.
For that many people, too. Like, how much food is that? That's a lot.
Right. And these are people whose entire belief system hinges on the apocalypse coming. I mean, they've been prepping for this
since day one, right?
Yeah. You're not going to catch them unawares.
Unawares, yes. On April 17th, Reno approved the tear gas plan. And then the following day, she briefed President Bill Clinton on the plan, who left the decision in her court.
Of course.
It's reported that when Reno approved the plan, she gave it, quote, only a cursory review, leaving tactical decisions to those at Waco.
I mean, okay, so, but if that's your job, to be the one who says yes or no to these types of assaults, shouldn't you, like, know what's going on and, like, know, kind of
be like, I don't know, read through it a little bit more than just you know, scanning it.
And have experience in it enough to be like, okay, well, if you do this, then this could happen. Or if you do, like, and she's just like, you figure it out.
Yeah.
Do I have to read the whole thing?
I know.
Okay.
It was really long.
At 6 a.m., a message was read over the loudspeakers placed outside of the compound, and the message said that the Davidians were under arrest and they had to come out. There was also a phone call placed to them, letting them know that tear gas would be deployed shortly. Okay. I feel so bad for these negotiators because they had to call and be like, listen, we're going to insert tear gas into the compound. This is not an assault, okay? We're not hurting you, okay? You don't worry about that. Just the tear gas will come in. We won't come in. Nobody's going to shoot you. Just the tear gas is happening. And they're like, well, how are you going to insert the tear gas? And they're like, with the tanks, of course. And they're like, but you just said you weren't coming in. We're not. The tanks are coming in a little bit, okay? So tear gas and some tanks. Other than that, nobody's coming in.
And it's not an assault.
It is not an assault. Please do remember that. Write that down. This is not an assault. It's like, well, you can tell me that all you want, but that feels like an assault.
Sounds like one, yeah.
Yeah. So at 6:02 a.m., the two FBI combat vehicles inserted gas into the compound through spray nozzles. And it wasn't like just a little spray nozzle went in. They took the tanks, rammed them into the building, and pulled out chunks of wall. Exterior. I mean, this is like essentially bulldozing parts of this compound. And then they insert the gas. And then they go to another area and do the same thing.
And they had already, not that, I mean, this might be like a small part of it. I don't know. But they had used the tanks to crush their vehicles.
Yep.
And they're like, it's not an assault.
Uh-huh. But crushed all of their vehicles. What was the point of that?
I know. Just as like a big middle finger to them, like, we can do whatever we want.
I personally feel like the commander of the hostage rescue team, and I forget his name, Bob Ricks was his name. I think this was just an absolute dick measuring contest for him. Do I agree with the Davidians are doing is right? No, I don't. Did it have to go this way? No, it did not. We literally removed the entire possibility of the justice system working at all.
Mm-hmm.
And
just turned the heat up.
Mm-hmm. And everything that happened, he just, I feel like he kind of took it as like, you're not going to make me look weak.
Mm-hmm.
Absolutely not. So I'm going to, like, the day that they ran over all the vehicles, nothing was really happening. And that was just pissing him off to no end. So he goes and runs over the vehicles with the tanks. Like, you're just provoking. But that's what he wanted to do. Like, I don't know. So then gunfire erupts. At 6:31 a.m., the HRT reported that the entire building was now filled with tear gas. Approximately 1 hour later, an FBI combat vehicle broke through the front of the building to make sure that the gas was inserted into all rooms of the compound. The HRT people said, well, at first we thought, but this is what they told them they were going to do, right? We're only going to put it in a small area of the compound.
And we're going to give them enough room and enough time to get out.
To get out. Well, that's not what they did. They started with a small area. You would think if they're going to expand it, they would have tried to call, and maybe they did and they didn't answer, but I don't think that's what happened. But now, you know, they're pulling chunks of this building out, and now they're trying to put it in everywhere. And the HRT is like, well, we were told that the tear gas was only going in a certain area of the compound. It's not even having any effect because they're all huddled up in a different area. So it's not even reaching them. Well, that's specifically what you told them you were going to do.
Yeah.
So
if
now we're just,
work, then
now we're just ripping the building down, trying to get it everywhere. You know, it's just very contradictory. Like,
well, from the beginning, I don't blame the Davidians for David Koresh for being like, this doesn't feel like, I don't trust this. Because everything that they said that they were going to do is exactly contradictory. It's like, okay, hypocrite, you just said you weren't going to do it, and then you big fat did it anyway.
Right, exactly. So how am I supposed to believe that you're trying to make this so that I can leave safely?
Right.
Yeah. Around noon, several fires were started throughout the compound. Again, it is widely disputed as to who started the fires. One of the HRT members reported seeing a male starting a fire inside the building. A total of 9 Davidians escaped the compound and were immediately arrested, of course. At 12:25 p.m., the FBI reported hearing, quote, systematic gunfire coming from inside the compound. They believed at this point that Davidians were either killing themselves or each other. Finally, at 12:41 p.m., firefighters were brought in to fight the blaze, which had completely engulfed the building. FBI representatives told the press they were no longer negotiating. The standoff is over. They have to come out. We're not giving them another option, right? The Davidians, who escaped the blaze later, told a different story. Before the tear gas was deployed, a message came over the loudspeakers saying, again, do not shoot. This is not an assault, over and over. The Davidians heard the pops of the tear gas being shot into the building. The adults had gas masks because, again, they are prepared.
They're prepared.
But they didn't have gas masks small enough for the children. So they ended up filling buckets with water, soaking cloths in it, and then holding them over the children's like noses and mouths. As soon as the first portion of the tear gas was deployed, the Branch Davidians began shooting. The FBI said, we never fired one round back. Davidian David Thibodeau remembered the combat vehicles breaching the compound walls, and he later said, quote, when the tanks started to come through the front door, I felt doomed at that point. I knew we were going to die. Everyone watched as the building burned, and everyone kept saying, I was waiting for this rush of people to come out. I'm watching, and I'm thinking, okay, they're going to run out because the building is completely engulfed in flames, and we know there are children in there. They got to come out. They got to come out. When are they going to come out? And after the initial 9 ran out, nobody else ever came out. Everybody else that was left inside, including David Koresh, was dead. That's 82 Branch Davidians, including 28 children total, were now dead.
So sad. Oh my gosh, it's so sad.
But also, like, the government is considering the people inside. They're using the term hostages. Isn't the goal to protect the hostages?
I mean, one would think so, unless... So David Koresh is the only one that's not a hostage? Or are we talking like Steve Schneider isn't either? Or, you know...
Right. It's a slippery slope, isn't it?
Was it Wayne Martin? Martin mm-hmm. Wayne?
Wayne Martin.
Yeah, like, are they not hostages, but everybody else is? Are the children the only ones who are hostages?
Right.
Are, I don't know.
And if you're viewing... Even if you're viewing only the children as hostages, but you are pumping, not just pumping them full of tear gas, but the way that like David Thibodeau described it was because the tanks had come in and ripped so much. I mean, it's basically a demolition at that point, right?
Mm-hmm.
Are you going to be able to just walk through the hallway and out the front door when tanks have demolished large portions of this building? No. He's like, you couldn't get anywhere. There was so much debris and things were closed off that had normally been a way out, right? Because it's all falling down around you. It's crumbling down. I can't get out that way. Mm-hmm. A lot of them were stuck.
Yeah.
Hey, you guys, have you ever wondered about the backstory, like why we call our dad Miss KB? We have gotten this question so many times, we thought we'd release a little freebie for you.
So we recorded a Patreon-exclusive Q&A last year, and be warned, we were outside and there was some wind, mm-hmm. where we answered this question, and we want y'all to have the answer even if you're not a patron.
Yeah, so be sure to head to killerqueens.link/MissKB, M-I-S-S-K-B, and grab the audio.
And don't forget, if you want the full Q&A or access to our entire catalog of over 450 patron-only episodes with all our regular episodes ad-free, you can join the Patreon for less than 1.5 Starbucks drinks per month.
I mean, that's a good deal.
It's a steal.
It is. It's a steal. You'll get 4 episodes per week from us, all ad-free, plus anything fun we do like Q&As or literally anything else. So definitely check it out.
And not every tier includes every episode?
Yeah, we do have different tiers, so just be sure everything's listed out there when you check it out. But in the meantime, be sure to grab your free audio about Miss KB and how he came to be called that at killerqueens.link/MissKB.
Now, I don't know who started the fires. I'll say that right now. I really don't know.
Mm-mm.
There is a lot of speculation that from people, even just people that I've talked to about Waco, they're like, I think that the Davidians started the fires. I don't know, because the FBI were very adamant about it not being an assault. And then they went ahead and, like I said, Big Fat did it anyway. So I don't know. But what do you think the gunshots were? Because they weren't shooting at the ATF agents.
I think they were killing themselves.
Okay.
Because they knew it was over. Either because they were completely trapped and they didn't want to burn to death, or...
Or like, this is
where I die for
like,
God.
Yes.
Yeah. And also, like, I read stuff that said that the FBI and the ATF knew that those tear gas rounds that they were firing in were very flammable. That they would likely start a fire. I don't know. Of course, they deny that. And I don't know enough about it to know either way. But it would seem odd. I mean, you would think that you wouldn't want to die in a fiery blaze if you have a choice.
You would think so. Yeah, I don't think.
And maybe they started the fires knowing that they were going to die by gunshot anyway, that wouldn't be what killed them, but they wanted to get rid of documents and evidence and whatever. I mean, I don't know.
The thing is, like, I mean, that's what we talked about at the very beginning of both the episodes. There are so many unanswered questions. We have no idea.
Yeah. And but either way, like, even if they did start the fires, it shouldn't have come down to that.
No. I mean, the whole thing is just really
thing.
Sad and a mess.
An absolute mess. I mean, yes, they wanted to do the raid. And once they found out about it, if they didn't do it that day, of course, Koresh is
going to... They would have been ready for it.
Right. And at this point, they'll get rid of the guns, right? They'll go hide them somewhere and, you know, whatever. Like, I understand that you kind of feel like, well, damn, we missed our chance. And now maybe we're not going to be able to get him like we thought we were going to.
But let's like take some time and let's think this through. Like, let's brainstorm. Mm-hmm. Is this a good idea? And not like, well, fuck it. We already got all the shit on. Let's just go.
Yeah. Well, I'm already dressed.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Put my boots on. Come on. It's just like, I don't know. I think it's one of those things that's like, I can hear the case. I can watch the things and I can be like, that doesn't feel right. I don't like that. This doesn't. I don't like that either. But I don't know enough about it to be like, here's what they should have done. But I right. also can see very clearly, of course, hindsight, whatever. But I'm like, nope.
Yeah.
Wrong.
Yeah. It just doesn't. And especially when you've got two agencies.
That isn't the goal the same? Shouldn't the goal be the same?
Right.
Yet they're doing the exact opposite of what, you know, like, mm-hmm. How frustrating to be like, okay, we're getting somewhere. And then your brother or sister company.
And they're making you look incompetent and that you're a liar and you're not being truthful. And you're like, I'm trying to establish this relationship and trust. And you're going right behind me and breaking it.
Well, and they're both... Well, it's just amazing to me, too. Like, the negotiators are like, okay, here's what we're going to do. And the ATF or the FBI is like, ugh, what's taking so long? Why can't you get anywhere with this? And it's like, well, if you'd give me a fucking chance and you trusted me a little bit, you know, it's like, quit. You want something done and you want it done when you want it done, but you don't want to do it yourself the way that it's supposed to be done. You know what I mean? It's like,
right.
So frustrating. The standoff had lasted a total of 51 days, and though it was over, people were shocked at what happened, obviously. I mean, knowing what I know now, I'm still shocked. I don't know. The public had questions, government officials had questions, and nobody seemed to have answers. Starting from the beginning, nobody knew who had actually tipped off the media that the raid was occurring. If this had not happened, the ATF may have been able to successfully carry out their plan without any casualties. It has long been rumored by law enforcement and the media that a member of the McLennan County Sheriff's Office was the one who told the reporter on February 28th. The accused sheriff deputy has consistently denied the rumors, but unfortunately, the journalists that were first on the scene were blamed by the ATF for the injuries and deaths of the four agents during the initial siege.
Did the reporters walk up to the building and start shooting?
They're like, well, if you guys hadn't blown our plan, then, like, well, you could have not fucking done it, though. You could have waited. You could have regrouped. Like, okay.
Yeah, and I do believe that there should be, I don't know. I know that it gets tricky, and I understand that, but there are times when media sharing information that can damage an investigation, which can then put other people at risk. Yeah. Like when they share information with the public that does not need to be shared yet, and they force an investigation's hand or a raid or whatever, like I think that the ATF made the wrong decision by going forward with it. And many of the agents today will tell you they believe the same thing. However, it absolutely should not have been. Like, the media needs to back off sometimes. Like, okay, mm-hmm. You want this story? Too fucking bad. Look how many people we put in danger because we wanted the story.
Right.
And people died.
Absolutely, absolutely. Now, I can see all that and I can hear what you're saying and I completely agree with you. But because it went so badly, I'm very grateful as someone who is really invested in this case. I'm glad for the footage now.
Right.
But it's like, which came first, the chicken or the egg? Like, if they hadn't gone mm-hmm. and gotten tipped off, would it have happened? Or, you know what I mean? Like, it's just, I don't know.
Yeah.
So, no concrete evidence has ever been released by the government or law enforcement to back up the claims that the journalists were to blame by the ATF. Regardless of how Koresh and the Davidians found out about the raid, a more important question stuck out. Why did the ATF continue with the raid, right? Like, why? Why? No explanation has ever been offered to the public. Though the media were easy scapegoats to blame for the botched job, there were several other mistakes that were made by law enforcement and ultimately overlooked. Just prior to the raid, ATF agents were getting ready near a busy interstate in their marked uniforms. Helicopter engines were running more than an hour before the raid, which would have been abnormal in that area. So all of these could have tipped off the Branch Davidians. However, from accounts from surviving Davidians, it seems that David Koresh only, like, when he first found out about the raid, it was from the mailman. So a later investigation into the fire that ultimately consumed the compound revealed that it was started from within the building. The FBI said that the Davidians initially started the fires. Now, and I don't know who started them. I really don't. But who's investigating this?
Right. It's the same government entity that...
Are we doing an internal investigation? Because if I investigate myself, I'm going to say, yes, he's right.
Yeah, exactly.
Me. I didn't do anything wrong. So I don't know, but... Take that for what it's worth or with a grain of salt, whatever. Mm-hmm. The FBI said that the Davidians intentionally started the fires. And David Thibodeau said that no one inside had ever mentioned starting fires. And he doesn't believe that anyone inside the compound would have started them. While negotiations between the FBI and the Davidians had a lot of problems, negotiator Gary Noesner safely secured the release of 35 Davidians, mostly children. He was asked to step down as chief negotiator after 4 weeks, and after he left, no more Davidians were released from the compound. Noesner later commented on how the intentions of the negotiators and the HRT differed drastically. He said, quote, they viewed me as an impediment to what they wanted. Noesner admitted that it would have been extremely difficult to get everyone out, saying, quote, it would have taken a long time, but impatience ended up undermining what we were doing. Noesner was at the FBI headquarters watching as Mount Carmel collapsed under fire. And He said it was the saddest, most painful day of his career. A day after the standoff ended, President Clinton addressed the nation regarding what had happened. Janet Reno admitted that she felt that the end result was her fault. Representatives from across the United States were blaming the federal government for what had happened. And in early 1994, the 11 surviving adult Branch Davidians were put on trial for conspiracy murder charges regarding the death of the four ATF agents. The 10 men and one woman faced the possibility of life in prison without parole if they were convicted on all of the charges. During the 7-week trial, the 911 call from Davidian Martin, no, Wayne Martin. He's got two first names and I keep wanting to interchange them and I don't know. Wayne Martin, that was made during the initial siege, was played for the jury, and they listened as Wayne Martin begged them to stop shooting because there were women and children inside. The Branch Davidian who'd left to be with her child, Kathy Schroeder, also testified, saying that the group did not have any plan to kill any law enforcement agents. Despite her unwavering support to Koresh and the Branch Davidians, Kathy did testify as to which roles each of the defendants played during the initial gunfire. And she received a lighter sentence because of testifying.
That's interesting, because that seems very... Kathy doesn't really make mention of that in any of the interviews that she has done.
Well,
like, yeah, I testified against.
I don't think that that would paint her in the light that she's trying to paint herself in. So
exactly.
That's an interesting and convenient detail to just leave out.
Like now she says, well, I just didn't have a gun on me. And if I had had a gun on me, I would have been shooting too. But I'm sure she wasn't saying that then.
Well, it wouldn't have gotten her the result that she was looking for, would it?
Exactly.
On the fourth day of deliberation, the jury returned with a verdict acquitting all 11 defendants of conspiracy murder charges. Five of them were found guilty of aiding and abetting voluntary manslaughter of federal officers. And one was found guilty of possessing a hand grenade. Another was found guilty of unlawfully possessing machine guns and aiding and abetting Koresh in the law unlawful possession of machine guns. Exactly 2 years after the violent end of the standoff at Mount Carmel, 24-year-old Timothy McVeigh deployed explosives outside the Alfred P. Murrah Federal Building in Oklahoma City, killing 168 people, including 19 children. And we've actually covered the Oklahoma City bombing. So if you want more about that case, we have a whole episode about it.
It's on the mixtape, right?
I think it is.
I believe it's a mixtape. So that's a Patreon, you know, like bonus episode, but that's where it
is. But if you find the need to want more about that, that's where you can find that.
Yeah.
So though McVeigh grew up with a fascination with guns and dislike for the government, he was upfront after he was apprehended about the two events that sealed his hatred for the government. So this is the standoff at Ruby Ridge between Randy Weaver, who'd failed to show up for his trial on weapons charges in the ATF. And then the standoff left a U.S. Marshal and a 14-year-old boy dead. The second event that truly upset McVeigh was Waco. I mean, remember, he was outside with everybody that had flooded it when it became national, international news. He was out there doing the bumper stickers, selling the hats, like doing all that kind of stuff. So he, like many other Americans, was disgusted at how the government handled the situation. Unfortunately, McVeigh went on to commit one of the worst terrorist attacks in U.S. history. Before his execution, he said that the Oklahoma City bombing was retribution for those who died at Ruby Ridge and Waco.
You're upset that you feel that innocent people were killed by the government, so you kill more innocent people.
Help me. The math ain't mathin'.
Including children. Even if you think that these people work in a government building, so they're evil, those children have nothing to do with any of it.
19 children. The original compound at Mount Carmel burned completely to the ground on that day in April of 1993. The Branch Davidians who survived created a new branch named the Lord Our Righteousness. It's based in a chapel on the property, and 82 trees were planted near the chapel in memory of those who died during the standoff. There was reportedly also a memorial site for the ATF agents who died during the siege. A tree was planted for David Koresh, but it was promptly cut down by the pastor.
Good for him.
Get this tree out of here! Yep. Like, I... Come on, get! Yeah, we don't... we don't want your kind. Like, I wouldn't want it either. I just don't think we should not memorialize.
No.
David Koresh.
So is this new branch, the Lord Our Righteousness, also a cult? Or is it supposed to be like...
And you hope to God it's not. But if Kathy Schroeder is a part of it and anything she has said is any indication, I would say yes, it is.
That's kind of what I'm thinking.
I don't know. But if I know Kathy like I think I do, probably.
It says here, Lord Our Righteousness Church, a man convinced his followers he was Christ, but was later imprisoned for sexual contact with minors.
Is this a new person? Jeez.
He founded this Lord Our Righteousness Church as a cult founded by Wayne Bent, born Michael Trebesser, in 2000. Believing God told him he was the Messiah, Bent moved to New Mexico with his followers and waited for the apocalypse. However, things started to go downhill for him when God told him he must sleep with seven virgins, lay in bed with naked children, and have sex with his daughter-in-law.
Jeez.
In 2016, he was released from prison and later wrote a book about his experiences.
So, I was right about my, and you were too, we both were right. Like, I mean, Alamo, they still have followers.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Heaven's Gate. They still have followers.
FLDS, right?
Yes, FLDS still have followers.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know if Jonestown does. I don't think so, but...
I feel like Jonestown might be one that's completely done. We're going to cover this on a doc jam soon. Shiny Happy People, the Duggar thing. That's a religious cult there. They've still got followers.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, it's just because you cut the head off the snake doesn't mean that it's over.
I mean, that's the point of an organization, is to be able to keep going. You know, you have a legacy. Even after the original. Yeah.
Sure.
Wow. Well, there you have it.
I can't get enough of learning as much as I can about Waco. So I appreciate you sending me the Hulu stuff, because I will be doing that after I run some errands later. And, you know, let us know. I mean, does anybody have any theories on the unanswered questions? You guys, what do you think?
Yeah, what do you think happened? Who do you think?
I mean, do you think it's to blame? Answer is, I feel like yes, but...
Mm-hmm. Yeah, because one of the followers of David Koresh said it's really easy to just blame everything on him, but he couldn't have been in a position to have absolute power unless we allowed him to have absolute power. He's like, you know, we had a part in it. I mean...
Yeah, I feel like on Mean Girls, when Katie is giving pieces of the crown to everyone, like, that's the blame that I'm going to be handing out here.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I mean, you know, there's every possible point that somebody could have dropped a ball in this entire thing, they dropped it. Just every point.
Except the negotiators, maybe.
Yeah.
But still, I'm just like, my mind is just blown by Absolutely. This entire case. So,
yeah. So let us know what you think.
Thank you guys so much for hanging out with us. We love you, and we will catch you on the next episode.
Bye.
Bye.
We'd love to hear your thoughts on this case. Connect with us on Instagram or Facebook to continue the conversation. Thanks for listening, and we will meet you back here next week.
Bye.
The theme song for the show is created and composed by Stephen Toby. You can find more of Stephen's work on SoundCloud. Our logo was created by Sloan Williams of Sophisticated Crayon. You can find more of her work on Etsy. Visit us at killerqueenspodcast.com for merch and other info about the show.